Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Much has been written on the influence of religion in American history. Far less has been available on secularism. Yet such free thinking, as some label it, is commonly associated with a number of our history's most prominent figures. Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and Abraham Lincoln, to name just a few. Susan Jacoby has added to our knowledge of this topic with her new book, Freethinkers, A History of American Secularism, and she will be discussing her book this week with Talking History's Fred Nielsen. And following that, we'll continue our series of readings from the recollections of field hospital service during the War of Secession, the unpublished reminiscences of T.V. Brown. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. The bride wore a dark blue silk dress with a soft gray fur cape. The groom was dressed in the same crumpled jacket that he'd been wearing for days, his Iron Cross, First Class, and other military decorations pinned to the lapel. The ceremony, held in a storeroom in a Berlin bunker, as Soviet artillery rained down on the city, lasted only 10 minutes. When the couple emerged, Adolf Hitler kissed Eva Braun's hand, and within 24 hours, both were dead. Hitler from a single bullet to the temple, Eva from biting on a cyanide capsule. This eyewitness account of the events of April 1945 by Heinz Linga, Hitler's butler, is among the more intimate revelations in a new book compiled by the KGB from interrogations of Linga and Otto Gunsch, Hitler's adjutant, after they were taken prisoner. The book was prepared for Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, but it was sealed for more than six decades until published this year. The Hitler book, as it's simply titled, describes the Nazi leader's life from his appointment as chancellor in 1933 to the final days in his bunker. The portrait that emerges is more complex than the conventional one-dimensional depiction of a monster, reviewers suggest. Hitler, it seems, personally ordered those who crossed him, even over minor matters, to be sent to concentration camps. But he also had a sense of humor, frequently mocking the pomposity of Hermann Göring, his number two person. When we return, Fred Nielsen interviews Susan Jacoby on American secularism. This is Talking History.
Hear me then.
Although often associated with the nation's founding fathers, secularism, according to our guest this week, actually peaked in influence in the United States between 1875 and World War I. And, she maintains, secularists led many of our history's greatest reform movements. Fred Nielsen discusses this interesting history with Susan Jacoby.
From the Puritans to the present, religion has been a central feature of American life. One cannot understand the history of the United States without it. But according to my guest, Susan Jacoby, one cannot understand America without also acknowledging its secular heritage. The Founding Fathers established a government based on human reason, not Christian creeds. And secularists have often led movements for social justice. Susan Jacoby is the author of Freethinkers, A History of American Secularism. Ms. Jacoby, welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
Let's begin with a definition. Your book is entitled Freethinkers. What exactly is free thinking?
Free thinking is a lovely word that appears at the end of the 17th century. And what it meant then was not necessarily that people didn't believe in God, but it meant opposition to religious and church authority. It meant that whatever your ideas about God were, they were yours to figure out, not some pope or minister or anyone else. Number two, they believed that religion should not dominate or dictate government. As we would put it now, they believed in separation of church and state. That is what all free thinkers believed in then. And really, it's a pretty good definition of free thought today. Free thinkers run the gamut from people who believed in a God who set the universe in motion but then stepped back, two people who didn't believe in God at all. What they all had in common was a belief that if there was a God, he'd given us reason as the means for understanding the natural world.
You mentioned reason. That was one of the central beliefs of many of the founding fathers in America in the 18th century. Men like Franklin and Jefferson believed in the power of human reason. What, for them, was the importance of that belief?
They believed in the power of human reason. That was part of Enlightenment philosophy. The idea, just at the dawn of the modern era, at the dawn of the attempt to understand the world through science rather than the world through what an angry God meant, they believed that we were responsible for fixing things, for thinking about problems, for eventually mastering the natural world. And that was the importance of reason as opposed to religious authority, which had dominated for centuries.
One of the revolutionary era's achievements, a kind of Enlightenment product really, was the separation of civil and religious authority in the United States. Jefferson's statute for religious freedom was passed in Virginia in 1786. And before its passage, his friend James Madison presented a memorial and remonstrance against religious assessments, which you suggest should be as familiar to students of American history as the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. What did Madison say exactly?
Well, it's important to know what this was in response to. There was a proposal in the Virginia General Assembly to assess taxes for support of Christian schools on all taxpayers. In other words, an attempt to solidify church and state. And they thought that this was going to pass. But then comes in the memorial and remonstrance and presents this great and unique idea in the history of the world, which later became the basis for the federal constitution, that we shouldn't be taxing anybody for the support of religious schools, that religious schools were up to religion, that the taxpayers shouldn't be financing them at all. And if you don't mind, I'll just read you one sentence. If religion be not within the cognizance of civil government, how can its legal establishment be said to be necessary to civil government? What influence, in fact, have ecclesiastical establishments had on civil society? In some instances, they have been seen to erect a spiritual tyranny. In many instances, they have seen the upholding of the thrones of political tyranny. In no instance have they been the guardians of the liberty of the people, unquote.
You mentioned that that leads to the federal constitution or influences it in part. Well, that's an interesting thing, and you make quite a lot of it in your book. God turns up in a lot of places, in state constitutions, even in Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. But God is not mentioned in 1787 in the Constitution.
Well, that's very important, and it was thoroughly debated at the time. Lots of state constitutions had a state church. I mean, for instance, it took Massachusetts 40 years to provide equal civil rights for Jews. Virginia led the way in separating church and state. And when it came time for them to sit down and write the Constitution in Philadelphia, they chose the Virginia model and not the Massachusetts model, thereby saying, well, the states may still be doing something different, but we're going to establish the first government in the world that doesn't give precedence to any religion, says you can believe or not believe anything you want to believe.
Thomas Paine occupies an interesting place in this discussion, I think. He's a central free thinker in your book. He's a central figure for the American Revolution, too, as the author of Common Sense. He should have been a hero. And yet his later writings, The Age of Reason, for example, which advance religious ideas of free thought, put him at odds with a lot of Americans, and he turns into a pariah.
Yes, he was a hero for a while. But then he writes two books, one called The Rights of Man, which was really an attack on economic privilege, and then followed by The Age of Reason, which doesn't say there's no God. In fact, Thomas Paine did believe in God. But what he didn't believe in was any church authority. He said any religious authority in government was a damnable thing for society. And he was called an atheist unjustly. But his whole reputation was then reversed in the 1790s. And from being a hero of the revolution, he became a pariah because of The Age of Reason, which was nevertheless a bestseller. It sold about 25,000 copies in post-revolutionary America, which is quite a lot.
You say that Abraham Lincoln is central to the history of American free thought. How does Lincoln figure into this?
Lincoln figures into it, first of all, because he's generally acknowledged to be our greatest president, and because he embodies so many things about the tension between secularism and religion in American life. Lincoln was so great a president. There are literally hundreds of books about Lincoln by people of different religions and no religions, claiming him as one of their own, like Lincoln True Christian, Lincoln Agnostic, Lincoln Premature Skeptic. The truth is that the impulses between religion and secularism were in almost perfect balance. And one of the things about Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, here is where he raises the question. He says, both the North and the South pray to the same God. But the Northern God tells Northerners to end slavery. The Southern God tells Southerners to fight to uphold slavery. His point being that we can't depend on God to answer these human political questions, since he speaks to each of us in a different voice, very different from the current political situation.
Freethinking's peak in terms of political and social influence came after the Civil War, between the years 1875 and 1914, you suggest. And perhaps the central figure in that period, he's perhaps the central figure in your book, is an interesting fellow, an orator and political figure named Robert Ingersoll. Could you talk about him a little bit?
Yes, Robert Ingersoll is also someone who deserves to be known in American history and is basically not mentioned in any standard history textbooks. He was the best-known orator of the last quarter of the 19th century. He spoke to more people than any American president. He literally spoke before millions of Americans at a time when lectures were a form of both education and entertainment, before television, before movies, before radio. People would sit for hours to listen to him. And what did he talk about? Rationality. He helped revive Thomas Paine's reputation, which had just evaporated in the 19th century for reasons that we've already discussed. He popularized Darwin's theory of evolution, then as now, a very controversial subject, although I think Ingersoll would have been very surprised to find that it's still controversial at the beginning of the 21st century. He talked about separation of church and state all of the time. He fought against religious-based censorship like the Comstock laws. I mean, it was a different America. Probably there were fewer people who had a secular approach to government than there are now. But they listened to him. There was an audience for this. He did a great deal to make thinking about these topics respectable. And he also, it was generally agreed at the time of his death in 1899, he would have had a major political career had he not been. He was known as the great agnostic, and this prevented him from having a major political career. Another reason why he's an important public figure. He would have been disgusted at people who pretend to be religious when they aren't today just to get elected.
It's interesting, even though he doesn't have a political career himself, he's close to politics and nominates, is it James G. Blaine, for president in 1884?
Yes, and not only that, but he's also close to Republican presidents who then were not on the religious right. And one of the things that's very interesting about the political climate then and now is I don't think any politician today would want an endorsement from a public figure who is an open agnostic. But indeed, all of the candidates for president did want his endorsement. While Ingersoll's agnosticism prevented him from having a political career, it didn't prevent people from wanting his endorsement and support, which it surely would today.
A lot of reform movements throughout American history have been infused with religious ideas, and yet women's rights seems to be a kind of special case as you present it. You write that no cause has better demonstrated the conflict between America's religious and secular values than the drive for women's rights. Why is that?
I think the reason that's true is simply that for so long, and it's not true anymore, but it was true at the time of the various movements for women's rights, beginning with the suffragist movement, that biblical authority was always cited as the reason why women shouldn't do this and that. St. Paul said, wives, be subject to your husband. Women, keep silent in the churches. All of those things meant that when you were fighting for women's rights then, in many respects, you were fighting a tradition of religious authority, which wasn't true, for instance, of the abolitionist movement. While there were, as Lincoln said, people used the Bible to justify slavery as well as to condemn it. You could find all sorts of things in the Bible to support the anti-slavery case, too. but you can't find anything in traditional old-fashioned religion to support equal rights for women, quite the contrary. So the battle for women's rights was always to some extent a battle against Orthodox religion. Again, I hasten to say religion today has been modified by this very movement, so it's a different thing. But then, really well through the first half of the 20th century, that was true.
Partly because of the contributions of those religious-based abolitionists in the 19th century and Martin Luther King more recently in the civil rights movement, we often tend to associate religion, Christianity, with movements for social justice. And yet that is, you suggest, something that can be often exaggerated. Indeed, secularists have often led the way and religious believers have stood in the way.
Well, let's be careful about using the word religious so broadly. Various kinds of religion have been involved in all reform movements, as have secular people. It was a matter of what kind of religion that you were talking about. The religious abolitionists, like the great Quaker Lucretia Mott, who also isn't very well known today, and William Lloyd Garrison, the editor of The Liberator, were devout religious believers, but they believed in a personal God. They didn't believe in the God of the churches, and indeed they were condemned by Orthodox churches in New England for speaking out themselves against church policies, which often said, well, let's go slow on slavery. Let's be mindful of our ties to Christian churches in the South. This idea that religion in the North uniformly supported the abolitionist movement is a complete misreading of history. There was religion and religion, just as there is now. There was religion that supported slavery and religion which attacked slavery.
Historically speaking, what have been the main differences in the United States between religious belief and free thought?
Well, again, I wouldn't say it's the difference between religious belief and free thought. Free thought was a kissing cousin of liberal religion, which also relied on human reason. Better ask, what are the differences between highly conservative religious belief and free thought? And the difference is very simple, I think, has really been quite well articulated by President Bush, who says he can't imagine someone being president without having a personal relationship with the Lord. What freethinkers say, what people like Lincoln said, is, I really wish that I had a personal pipeline to God, but since I don't, I have to rely on my own reason, the facts of the case, figuring out among ourselves, among human beings, how to solve these problems, and not say that we have a personal pipeline to God to justify whatever our political and social views happen to be.
Well, Ms. Jacoby, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed this.
I've been speaking with Susan Jacoby, the author of Freethinkers, A History of American Secularism.
The people of this day have a tendency to try to lay down old-time religion, but I have decided to retain the old-time religion. I believe the others have, too. But I want to lay my religion down. Lord, I want to lay my religion down.
We now continue with our reading from T.B. Brown's Recollections of Field Hospital Service During the War of Secession, an unpublished manuscript owned by the Clendenning Library of the University of Kansas Medical Center. Theodore Brown, you may recall, was born in Germany in 1836. He emigrated to the United States and enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1857. In 1861, the year the Civil War began, he was appointed hospital steward, a position he held for the entirety of his military career, which lasted into the 1880s. Brown wrote his recollections in 1894. In this excerpt, David Jones reads from Brown's memories of the Battle of Gaines Mill, June 27, 1862.
It is not easy to interest one's self in another man's wounds when bullets are continually zipping past one's ears. Nevertheless, I watched Dr. Sternberg's actions and imitated them. "My poor fellow, where are you hurt?" I would ask. "Right here in my right arm," was the reply. Seeing no wound of exit, I would feel for the bullet, find it, compress the surrounding parts with the thumb and forefinger of my left hand, cut down to the bullet, insert the little finger of my right hand under it, yank it out, put a bandage around the arm, and shout, "Next man!" Thus we worked about 1/2 hour, doing little good, for all these men could just as well have walked a mile further to the rear and been properly attended to at the field hospital. I doubt that we were instrumental in saving any man's life, and feel that my ignorant surgery did more harm than good. While thus engaged, our division commander, General George Sykes, cantered slowly past us as cool and leisurely as though he were out for a pleasure ride after breakfast, a soldierly man indeed, who never shows fear even though he feel it. The musketry fire had not been in progress 10 minutes before we observed a sort of skirmish line of men, without excuse of wound of any kind, heading for the rear, coolly showing the white feather. And there seemed to be no one to stop them, and none were after punished for cowardice. This was the more extraordinary when it is borne in mind that these were regulars. It must not be forgotten, however, that the majority of the officers of the regular army cast their lot with the rebels at the beginning of the war, and a loyal minority were appointed to higher command with volunteer troops, leaving the regular regiments very poorly officered with new men appointed, for the most part, from civil life. The regulars were, in fact, very little better than volunteers at the beginning of the war, while the volunteers were regulars at its close. During the time we were on the battlefield, artillery of both sides played but a very insignificant role, the two lines of battle being too close to each other to permit the artillery to get in its work. It was indeed a very matter-of-fact battle thus far. The small fire of the two lines sounded like the combustion of a lot of firecrackers on a 4th of July or Chinese New Year. Occasionally, a shell was sent by the enemy in our direction, much to our disgust, and three of our hospital detachment were wounded. Whether the enemy purposely fired upon us, I cannot say, but it had that appearance. Major B. Russell, the regimental commander, had gone into battle in a showy uniform mounted upon a fine black horse, and all too soon paid the penalty of his rashness. Little more than 1/2 hour after the action begun, he was brought to us shot through the left breast, and his adjutant, Dr. Sternberg, and I accompanied his letter to the field hospital, a little more than 1 mile away. And I fear that we were all glad of the excuse to leave the battlefield, to which we did not return. The farmhouse and orchard that served as field hospital were already crowded with severely wounded Zouaves, 5th New York, a splendid body of brave men, and numerous corpses were in sight. It was a sad spectacle. Soon after our arrival, Major Russell addressed Dr. Sternberg, as yet in a very audible and natural voice. "Can you do nothing for me, Doctor?" "Nothing, Major," answered Dr. Sternberg sadly. "Then all stand aside and let me talk to the adjutant," said the dying officer. And whispering a last message to his family in his adjutant's ear, he breathed his last. This was the Battle of Gaines Mill, fought June 27, 1862. The regiment went into action with about 400 men on June 27th, but then 200 answered roll call that night, and we supposed that over 1/2 of the men had been killed or wounded. Next morning, however, one after another of the supposed dead and injured put in an appearance, until it was plain that less than 30 had remained on the battlefield.
listening to David Jones, a student in the graduate theater program at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, read from T.V. Brown's Recollections of Field Hospital Service During the War of Secession. Our thanks to the Clendenning Library of the University of Kansas Medical Center for allowing us to use Recollections. We'll continue our reading next week. But in the meantime, if you miss the opening readings of Recollections, you can find them at the OAH website. Just go to oah.org, click on Talking History, and download our program dated September 19, 2005. This is Talking History. That's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beattie is our producer, and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need to do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.